My name is Scott Urie from Tel Aviv University, where I head up the Roth Institute for Study of Antisemitism and Racism, partner institution, and a proud partner institution with the Peirce Institute here at Birkbeck. And I'm delighted, not because it's this last substantive panel, but I'm delighted to chair the panel, which is on the topic of BDS in the global era. We'll have three speakers, Sina Arnold from the Technical University in Berlin. We'll be speaking about the BDS movement and anti-Semitism in the United States, a collision of frames, no question mark. No question mark? No question mark. The second, the second speaker, I thought maybe it was a typo, I don't know. The second speaker is Alexandra Gliszynska-Grabias from Poznan, from Mickiewicz University in Poznan, if I'm not mistaken. No, there are others, there's another university in Poznan? From the Institute of Legal Studies of the Polish Academy of Sciences in Poznan. In Warsaw, oczywiście, ja przepraszam. Dlaczego myślałam Poznan? Nie wiem. Okay. She'll be speaking about anti-Israel boycotts, an international human rights perspectives. And our last speaker will be Philip Marfleet from the University of East London. We'll be speaking about boycott, localism, and activism. Sina Arnold, our first speaker, is a PhD candidate at the Technical University in Berlin. She's working there with the Center for this Research on Antisemitism. Tim did his work as well, and other people. Her past academic work focused on anti-Semitism and identity among Arab youth in Berlin and within the German left, as well as on educational concepts against anti-Semitism. Her current research, which is her PhD dissertation, okay, deals with perspectives on anti-Semitism and left social movements in the United States after 9/11. Alexandra Gliszynska-Grabias graduated from the Faculty of Law at Adam Mickiewicz University in Poznan, and now she has moved from the provinces to the center. She is currently an assistant professor of the Poznan Human Rights Center, Institute of Legal Studies at the Polish Academy of Sciences, where Grzegorz is also working in the Institute of History, and she's defended her PhD on counteracting anti-Semitism with legal instruments within the context of international human rights. So there's some continuation with the last speaker, Ken Marcos, who is, I guess, stuck in traffic on the way to Heathrow, probably. And our last speaker on this panel is Philip Marfleet of the University of East London. He's a professor of migration and refugee studies and has written extensively on globalization, migration, refugee histories, racism, and exclusion in Europe, and on contemporary social and political affairs. And without any further ado, I'm delighted to invite Sina to the stage.
So in my presentation, I will address one of the central questions that the call for this conference put out, namely, what terms and which political vocabularies do advocates and opponents of boycotts use to promote their causes? I will do this focusing on recent debates around BDS in the United States. And my data is based on qualitative interviews with pro-Palestinian and anti-war activists, on participant observations at events and conferences, as well as an analysis of movement literature. I will show that debates around BDS are taking place in a social field that's structured by a variety of political forces, and accordingly by different colliding frames, no question mark, leading to political gridlock. And I would also argue that this dynamic is symptomatic for debates on anti-Semitism and on the Middle East's conflict in the US left, more broadly speaking. So this is an analysis that also hopes to contribute to this to debates around so-called new anti-Semitism and an extension campus anti-Semitism, which also focus on the political left as one of the central actors. I will first give an overview of BDS and its critics in the US and then present a concrete example that I would like to use for illustration. Say a few words about frame analysis, and then I'll name the central discursive frames of BDS opponents and advocates. And I'll finally turn to this frame collision and the consequences. So in the US, the first boycott activities against Israel started after the UN conference on racism in Durban 2001. Petitions were handed around for divestment at around 50 American universities, both by students and by professors. And then it gained momentum after 2005 and in recent years. And to this day, the BDS campaign is most prominent on college campuses. So there, the issue is mostly about divestment, so withdrawing college funds from Israeli companies or from companies that benefit from the occupation specifically. As of date, no American university has divested from Israel, but the campaign is very visible in this arena. BDS has in recent years been accused of furthering anti-Semitic positions or of being outright anti-Semitic. And I'd say it's no exaggeration that these debates around BDS on US college campuses have been something like a microcosm of debates around anti-Semitism from and within the left. And what I'd like to do is kind of explore that microcosm by focusing on the two sides of the debate, so BDS advocates and BDS opponents. And of course, that's difficult because we're talking about a diverse movement with different positions. Most of the BDS advocates, however, are in some way or the other identifying with the left. And the critics, also very diverse, most of them are on the political right, but there have been also prominent leftists such as Noam Chomsky and Norman Finkelstein have been critical of BDS. But in order to stress these opposing viewpoints, I'll kind of take the harshest position on those sides as examples. More specifically, the example I would like to use is a panel discussion that took place on February 7th of this year at Brooklyn College in New York City, which it was entitled BDS, Movement for Palestinian Rights, and it featured Omar Baghouti and Judith Butler. That's the poster for the event. So Butler, I'm sure you're familiar with, and Omar Baghouti is one of the leaders of the BDS movement. He has also come up in past presentations here at the event. It was initiated by Students for Justice Against Palestine, a group that does Palestinian advocacy work around 80 college campuses. And the political science department at Brooklyn College, which is part of CUNY, the City University of New York, co-sponsored the event alongside with other groups. So weeks before, a public debate evolved that gave the event national media attention. Opponents criticized the department for co-sponsoring and called for it to cancel or withdraw its sponsorship. Among them was the lawyer and public commentator Alan Dershowitz, the Anti-Defamation League, several assemblymen, 10 members of the city council. There was a student petition, as well as threats to withhold funding to all of Brooklyn College. And then on the other side, New York Mayor Bloomberg got involved, criticized BDS, but supported the right for the event to happen. And in the end, the panel took place with police outside checking bags, 150 protesters in front of the building, 200 attendees that had their names on an approved list. And during Butler's speech, four Jewish students were removed from the event because they held flyers with differing positions in their hands, which caused the controversies to continue because the organizers got accused of anti-Semitic motives in the removal of the students. And there were also threats to use the Title VI claim that Kenneth elaborated upon this morning. So CUNY launched an investigation. They interviewed 40 witnesses. They released a 40-page report after 2 months. And the report stated that while a lot of things were not well planned during the event, there was no evident intent to discriminate based on the removed students' religion. So that's just a short descriptive background, and I think it kind of makes clear how heated these debates are and that they take on a wider political relevance, and also how there's very little room for an actual debate. And I want to try to better understand these dynamics by using a frame analysis. So a few words on political framing. This approach has, in the past 20 years, become kind of one of the central paradigms of social movement research. So frames are schemes of interpretation which allow to identify and categorize events and people. Such a scheme of interpretation simplifies and condenses the world out there by selectively punctuating and encoding objects, situations, events, experiences, and sequences of actions within one's present or past environment, to quote David Snow and Robert Banford. So framing functions in a way like a frame around a picture, surprise. The attention gets focused on which issues need to be highlighted and which can be ignored. And that also helps movements to explain their actions and to motivate their members. So analyzing collective action frames in this case allows us, I think, to answer the two following questions. So for the BDS movement, what counts as a political problem and what, by extension, doesn't? And secondly, how do BDS opponents present competing interpretations by way of counterframes? So I'm going to turn to the central frames of BDS analysis. So when looking at BDS arguments, and those are always, you know, very strongly linked to an analysis of the Middle East conflict, there are a few central frames that are repeatedly being stated. So very dominant is the anti-racism frame that portrays BDS actions in this paradigm We find self-description such as, quote, BDS is an anti-racist movement against the daily brutal occupation of Palestine and military threat to the region by the state of Israel, unquote. In this frame, Israel is portrayed as either an inherently racist state or a state with a specific, very specific racist politics. And this is the frame that that has become very dominant after Durban. I agree with what Jen Chalcraft said this morning. And strongly linked to this is an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist frame. So Uma Bugutti says about the BDS calls that they are, quote, directed strictly against Israel as a colonial power that violates Palestinian rights and international law, unquote. Or Butler, in her presentation, she speaks of BDS as, quote, opposition to oppression, to the multifaceted dimensions of a militarized form of settler colonialism, unquote. So this opens the way for apartheid comparisons, the consequences of which Ilka Schröder pointed out in her presentation earlier. This frame is also used in alternation with an anti-imperialist frame, which, apart from the US, perceives Israel as the center of imperialism. Another central frame is freedom of speech or academic freedom. For example, the event's co-sponsors, Jewish Voice for Peace, they collected signatures in support of the event under the title Support Free Speech and Open Debate at Brooklyn College. But for BDS advocates, freedom of speech means more than being able to conduct events. It also means having a university that is free of the influence by pro-Israel organizations like AIPAC. Furthermore, Jewish identity claims are often used in BDS debates. Often they are used as a counterframe. So to refute accusations of anti-Semitism, Jewish members use a form of strategic essentialism to make themselves visible, or they're being made visible by others. So for example, in criticizing BDS opponents, Uma Bugutti writes, quote, the growing support among progressive European and American Jews for effective pressure on Israel is one counterargument that is not well publicized, unquote. Another important argument is to frame the call for boycott and divestment as an issue of human rights. So, for example, Butler in her speech at the event portrayed BDS primarily as a movement to achieve basic political rights for Palestinians. Or a handbook for student divestment campaigns that points specifically to the strategic use of this frame when dealing with political opponents. It reads there, be sure you can set the terms for the debate. Don't let your main points drown in a sea of details about past peace deals or 2,000 years anti-Semitism. Stick to your main point that human rights are being violated. So I want to now turn to the main frames of BDS opponents. The main frame in portraying BDS is anti-Semitism. Here are some quotes concerning the debate again. A trustee at CUNY said, these BDS advocates single out Israel as a cover for rank anti-Semitism. Or a Brooklyn assemblyman that said, we're talking about the danger of a second Holocaust here. Or the editor-in-chief of the Jewish publication Allgemeine that said on a public panel that the BDS movement is an anti-Semitic movement. Secondly, on the part of BDS critics, there is a mirror to the Jewish identity frame, Jewish self-hatred. So that's an accusation that is mostly directed by Jewish critics towards Jewish participants. In the debate at hand, Jewish commentators called Butler a self-hating Jew by any standard. That's a quote. And so that's an experience that Jewish activists report upon frequently, that they're being called Nazis during demonstrations by other members of the Jewish community and so forth. And then finally, the frame of academic freedom is not only applied by BDS advocates, but also by BDS critics. It takes a bit of a different turn, though. So BDS advocates, they demand the right to bring up specific issues or to have a critical discussion. And the bottom line to that argument is that academia is supposed to be free of political influence or of lobby groups like AIPAC trying to push an agenda. BDS critics take a similarly structural approach. But their take, in their perception, academic freedom suffers from a liberal bias. So this causes faculties to endorse panels like this and makes for an anti-Israel bias in classrooms. Alan Dershowitz, for example, said concerning the event, shame on the Brooklyn College Political Science Department for falsely invoking academic freedom and freedom of speech to deny equal freedoms to those who disagree with its extremist politics. And according to Manfred Gerstenfeld, he's board member of the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, quote, the boycott actions against Israel have brought further proof that tenured radicals have permeated a number of faculties and campuses where they try to undermine society rather than objectively pursue knowledge, unquote. So I want to now turn to the way why these different frames are pretty much irreconcilable, and moreover, why they're often standing in the way of truth-seeking, because they show analytical shortcomings. We find that the following dominant divergent frames, they are bound to collide. So the biggest clash that I see is between the anti-racist and linked with it the anti-colonial or anti-imperial frame on the one hand and anti-Semitism on the other. The dominance of the anti-racism frame has significant influence because in the US, it leaves no place for Jews. Due to a process of upward mobility, Jews have since World War II undergone a process of whitening in the United States. And I would say that in a country that's so shaped by the black and white divide and whose social movements are highly influenced by the abolitionist movement, by the civil rights movement, this is a perception that has political consequences. Because if you're perceived as white, it automatically puts you on the wrong side of power. And then Jewish privilege, coming out of the concept of white privilege, that's also partly inspired by critical whiteness studies, causes Jews to be perpetrators and not victims in the left perception. And it can reinforce stereotypes about Jews' power and Jews' influence. And strong leading to this is this association of Jews and Israel with imperialism. One interview partner that was critical of this common left view said, "Jews are the epitome of white imperialism," which sums it up well, I think. But I think when you see the Middle East conflict only in the frame of imperialism or colonialism, and an extension of apartheid, then there's no room for addressing, for example, Palestinian anti-Semitism or Israelis' needs for security from rocket attacks, for example. So none of that gets addressed. And what we find instead is some kind of double standard of self-determination, where any kind of political methods used on the Palestinian side are endorsed, and on the Israeli side, they get criticized because of the structural inequality in this situation. On the other hand, on the part of BDS critics, we find over hasty accusations based on too limited an analysis. So when you consider a movement to be per se anti-Semitic, then this delegitimizes any of its efforts, because then their demands fall into the category of hate speech. And I would argue that it's not just above mentioned analytical shortcomings that causes anti-Semitism to be near invisible or near invisible topic for the left, but it's also this blindness is also a reaction. So these hasty accusations also result in an unwillingness to take criticism seriously on the part of activists. And accusations of anti-Semitism have the effect of making it seem like a topic that's inherently right-wing. So to quote Butler's speech again, "We may not exploit or reignite the traumatic dimension of Hitler's atrocities for the purposes of accusing and silencing those with opposing political viewpoints, including legitimate criticisms of the state of Israel. Such a tactic produces a general cynicism about both accusations of anti-Semitism and predictions of new genocidal possibilities," unquote. And according to the Deputy Director of Jewish Voice for Peace, BDS opponents should be, quote, "held responsible for desensitizing an entire generation to real anti-Semitism," unquote. Now, on the part of BDS, it is remarkable, and I would say it's somewhat symptomatic for the US left, that anti-Semitism is not a frame at all regarding the Middle East conflict. I think this has to do with shortcomings in the analysis, where specific theoretical traditions within the political left have resulted in ignorance, if not rejection, of anti-Semitism as a relevant political issue. So when anti-Semitism is brought up as a subject, American leftists react with denial, with blame shifting, or with relativization. And I think it's symptomatic that these accusations of anti-Semitism are never taken at face value, so something to be scrutinized, and on the grounds of a careful analysis, either accepted or rejected. So a signature call by Jewish Voice for Peace claimed that BDS, in no way can be construed as anti-Semitic, unquote. And it doesn't take into account that, of course, anti-Semitism can be one motive in wanting to boycott Israel. This dynamic, Robert Fine has called this dynamic anti-Semitism denial, which means the reluctance or refusal to take seriously the charge of anti-Semitism in relation to criticism of Israel. So rather, concern over anti-Semitism is seen merely as a camouflage that's designed to invalidate criticism of Israel. Concerning the next colliding frame, we can observe that an inner Jewish debate about identity, about representation, universalism versus particularism, gets acted out in a political arena that is not exclusively Jewish. So according to Jewish Voice for Peace, these disagreements reveal an authentic crisis in the Jewish community, And a blogger for the Israeli online magazine, Plus972, commented after the panel, "Often I feel as though the whole Palestine issue is more about the divisions within the Jewish community than about actual Palestinians." Concerning academic freedom, we find both sides actually applying the same frame, but we find conflicting interpretations of what academic freedom actually means. Is it the right to free speech or the right to free expression within an unbiased framework? And if the latter, then what bias does that framework lean towards? So as I explained above, BDS advocates perceive a strong right-wing or Zionist influence on campus. BDS opponents, a structural liberal dominance. So here, the starting point could be actually to further discuss the meaning of academic freedom, of freedom of speech, its specific limits on a more general level first. The human rights frame is also one that is not in and out of itself opposed by anyone involved. So discursive struggles take place within it. What do human rights mean exactly regarding Palestinian refugees and the right of return, regarding the Israelis' need for security, regarding civil rights in Israel, and so on? So this leads me to my conclusion. I'm out of time. Awesome. I think the panel discussion between Butler and Baghouti and the debates surrounding it proved to be a showcase for general features of BDS debates in the United States. It shows that movement actors must be aware of how they frame their arguments and the effect that these frames may entail. Today, these strongly divergent frames have caused or have created a kind of political gridlock. Yet most frames omit something. So anti-Semitism can play into a BDS debates and needs to be called out, just as racist and otherwise reactionary positions need to be challenged. And while the clash illustrated above between frames highlighting anti-racism versus anti-Semitism and Jewish identity versus Jewish self-hatred have proven difficult to transcend, debates which mobilize the potentially shared values of academic freedom and of human rights could offer a possible space for reconciliation. And it's also, it seems that focusing on the actual arguments, rather than either A, psychologizing the other side by calling them self-hating, or B, seeing the arguments as mere camouflage for hidden anti-Semitic or hidden right-wing agendas, would be an important starting point, if not a precondition to better analyze BDS as a current political boycott movement.